Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're beginning the show today by talking with you about traffic safety. We got a good expert for you, Randy Wiesinger, a 29-year veteran of the Dane County Sheriff's Office before his retirement. He's currently a consultant for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Safety. And as we talk with him today, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about how to stay safe on the roads? What have you observed? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Randy Wiesinger, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be here.
You retired in 2015. You had 29 years with the Dane County Sheriff's Department. How much has traffic safety been the focus of your career?
Well, prior to my retirement, over half my career was with the Traffic Enforcement Unit in Dane County, a motorcycle enforcement unit. So it's been a focus of my career throughout, but the last half I was dedicated strictly to traffic enforcement, and I've been doing traffic safety consulting since then.
I want to go into more detail a little bit later on about driver's education, but from your perspective, how important is driver's education for teenagers?
Well, it's absolutely critical. And as a parent that had three kids come up through the teen years and learn to drive, I was very passionate about it then. I personally investigated numerous traffic fatal crashes that involved teen drivers, and those are always hard to deal with. And so that all has been a passion of mine throughout.
Yeah, I think we had something like 580 traffic deaths or fatalities in the state in 2023, and I think between 2019 and 2023, there were a couple hundred of them were teenagers, young drivers.
Yeah, our teens, throughout the state, and we're not necessarily unique in that way, unfortunately, across the country. Teens are overrepresented in crashes, so they can represent in any given community or county, anywhere from 12 to 20% of the crashes, but they're usually only about 5% of our drivers.
Yeah.
So they're not always at fault. I'm quick to point that out. The teen isn't always at fault, but due to their lack of experience behind the wheel, they may not avoid a crash that you or I might avoid.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking about cell phones a bit. I don't know how many times I've had a stop sign and the light changes and the car in front of me is not going anywhere, and you can see that the person is looking at their cell phone.
Yeah, and I'm not, I don't think it would be proper to say that that's just teens.
No.
Actually, our teens and younger people have had cell phones in their hand their entire life, where older people, it's still new technology, and so I think sometimes middle age and older people are more distracted by cell phones than younger people are, but it's definitely a problem, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's distracted driving, I think is what it's called.
That is correct.
And there were, and this kind of a law, I mean, it's, you're not supposed to be looking at your phone, but enforcing that must be difficult.
Well, yeah, it is. In Wisconsin, we have a state statute that prohibits texting while driving. It's been around for a number of years now, but for decades and decades, we've had a state statute that addresses inattentive driving, and they're really kind of the same. Whether you're paying, whether you're distracted by the radio on your dash, the phone in your hand, or the McDonald's meal in your lap, distracted driving is a problem. It's not always the phone.
Yeah. And yesterday, I think it was yesterday, it was buckle up, phone down day, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
That was a campaign by the DOT, and it was just to urge drivers to put their phones down and quit eating that McDonald's burger
Yep, it's a unique campaign. I mean, we're always trying to get more people to wear seatbelts. Thankfully, in Wisconsin, our seatbelt usage rate as of last year has climbed up to 92%. People are buckled up, which is great because it's a life-saving action that everybody can take. But then the distracted driving is definitely a focal point of traffic safety.
Yeah. Cater and Herbster has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cater.
Hey, in the last 10 years, all over the country or different places in the country, I've seen this huge increase in street racing, not only on the interstate, but in cities. And I wonder if you could tell me about the law enforcement issues with that, how they are communicating with each other, and what you should do if a pack of cars going 150 miles an hour on the interstate is suddenly all around you.
What do you think, Randy?
You know, it's one of those things that it is a problem in certain communities, certain jurisdictions. It's not widespread, thankfully, around here. It's a big challenge for law enforcement because of technology, right? These people have lookouts, if you will, so they're gonna disperse if law enforcement shows up, and so it. But law enforcement does the very best that they can to try to track them down. If you witness it, by all means, it's a 911 call, and I would either pull over and stop or disengage yourself from being around those reckless drivers.
Yeah. George in Janesville, we'll go to you. George, what's on your mind?
Well, I've got a couple things, but the first thing is the problem with elderly and handicapped drivers and the challenges of very low street lighting now and bright headlights. And the police aren't doing anything about people who don't dim their headlights. In fact, probably at least 10 to 20% of the public is driving around with bright headlights on. That's one thing that bothers me.
I think part of that is a mechanical thing with the kinds of the new lights, Randy.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the frequency of people having their high beams on is that high versus the perception that they have their high beams on because of newer, brighter LED technology, which I will agree is kind of a balancing thing. I have a newer vehicle that has pretty bright lights, and it's really nice to be able to see at night and both the side of the road and further out. But at the same time, those lights are pretty bright when they're coming at you. An age-old technique that we teach people, including teenagers, whether they're on their high beams or not, or just these newer headlights, is not look at the lights. It's counterintuitive. Human instinct is your eyes are going to track towards the oncoming lights, but you really need to focus on the white line to your right until those lights go by, so you're not blinded by those lights.
Oh, that's a good tip. Just keep your eyes on the white line on the right so you're not going to drive off the road, but then you're not blinded by those lights that are coming at you in the middle of the night on Interstate 90.
Yeah, and again, and technology is great, right? We have better cars, safer cars. A lot of the newer cars have auto sensing bright lights. That's what my vehicle has. We're an oncoming vehicle. It'll automatically dim those lights, but I think that they still are perceived to being on high beams, but they're not.
Dennis in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good morning. I have a kind of a comment question. I don't know if people realize that. I don't think most people do, that when we have these vehicles today whose headlights are on all the time or come on automatically when conditions warrant it. The problem, and it makes no sense to me, that 95% of these vehicles, at least 95, only have headlights on.
As opposed to?
Taillights, unless you override it.
Oh, okay. Randy, comment on that?
Yeah, I can't really comment or validate the percentage, but I do know that when daytime running lights, that's what he's referring to, daytime running lights became, you know, kind of the commonplace, and that they've been around for quite a while, that you're just your daytime running lights, and they're not even full headlights, would be on all the time. It presented a couple of challenges for drivers of newer vehicles. One, they thought that their daytime running lights are on all the time, so they didn't have to turn on their lights in times of poor visibility, like fog, like we had this morning, and we frequently have, and it doesn't turn on your actual headlights, and or it doesn't turn on your taillights. So that's a driver education issue, you know, and I really think it starts with the dealers, and the people that buy these vehicles need to know how to operate these vehicles and when their lights are on or when they're not.
Yeah, I tell you what, the vehicles are a lot different in terms of what they can do or can't do for you than when you and I started driving.
That is very true.
Very true indeed. You can join in too today as we talk. We're focusing on driver's education, but of course dealing with all matters relating to being on the road with our guest today, Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff's Detective, currently law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT Bureau of Transportation Safety. And he's the owner of Wiesinger Consulting, LLC, based in DeForest. Questions or comments for him, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at driver safety and driver's education today with Randy Wiesinger, who is a law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT and is owner of Wiesinger Consulting based in DeForest. Great to have him along. Questions or comments? I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Mark in Boulder Junction has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing today, Larry? And hope your guest is surviving his driver's ed courses. being a rules guy, and I was a basketball ref for many years, what WIAA did is they showed videos that you were required to watch just for new rules. And to me, I think the DOT misses a chance when people go in there to require them to just sit and some of the most common errors we make in driving, just a video to watch, nothing to try to get people out of driving, just to remind people. And we all make mistakes, but there's so many things I think older drivers have forgotten and just gotten in bad habits. And then just a second question. Do they actually do a on-road test for older drivers, you know, 70 and older? Probably wouldn't be a bad idea.
All right, Randy, comments. A couple of things there.
I like that idea. I do believe there's other states that have continuing education. I know there are. Wisconsin does not really per se, certainly doesn't mandate anything. Once you have your license and keep renewing it, you're kind of on your own. But I think that's it's a great opportunity. I'm not in charge of the Department of Motor Vehicle and license renewal or that type of stuff. So, you know, again, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I will say that it can be a personal choice. There are resources available. We don't re-road test older drivers unless they're referred by law enforcement through a report called a driver condition report. Law enforcement might encounter somebody that is involved in a crash and doesn't think that their driving skills are where they're supposed to be. They can fill out a driver condition report, and that will mandate they go into DMV and be retested. But short of that, there's a lot of resources out there, and especially organizations like AARP, for example, has an older driver education course that you can offer in your community. But right now, that's a proactive thing. You'd have to take the initiative yourself in your community to do that. ADRC is in a lot of communities. They have education opportunities as well. Because I will tell you that older drivers, I made a comment earlier about teen drivers, are overrepresented in crashes based on the number of people holding a license as a teen. The same can be said. We use 65 and older. It's just an arbitrary number, but the older you get, the more your skills diminish in driving, and the faster things are happening out there. But the more important factor there is that the older we get, the less survivability we have of a crash. So my example is a 30-year-old can be involved in a crash, and a 65 or 70-year-old can be involved in the exact same crash, and they're going to have much more severe injuries. So there's an opportunity there to educate our older drivers.
Daryl in Wausau, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Daryl.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Say, I do a lot of driving and a lot often at night or after dark. And one thing I really noticed in the last, 15 years or more, that people don't realize they don't have any lights on their vehicle when it gets dark. And I think some of that is because in the older vehicles, if you did not have at least your marker lights on, your dash would still. Now these newer.
You're breaking up, unfortunately, Daryl. But Randy, I think you got the gist there.
Yeah, and it kind of relates to one of the earlier callers. That's the technology that a lot of vehicles have, where the daytime running lights come on. And in some vehicles, that includes your dash lights. And so unless you are aware and knowledgeable with your particular vehicle, you may misunderstand that your taillights aren't on. In urban areas, we have better lights. Street lights a lot of times are LEDs now. And so we see cars driving down the road that don't have any lights on whatsoever. They just don't perceive that. But that's a driver behavior, driver education issue. People need to know exactly how their car works.
Daryl, thank you again. Courtney in Madison, your turn. Hi, Courtney.
Good morning. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having the platform and this education. I appreciate both of you. My question today is how to be a good defensive driver when driving around roundabouts. Often there are some vehicles that, don't quite know how to get through the roundabout safely, and they might turn off early and they're in the wrong lane. So what would be some good tips to be a defensive driver in roundabouts?
Well, first and foremost is speed. Reduce your speed. Roundabouts have saved countless lives and injuries because they don't always reduce the number of crashes, but they reduce the severity of those crashes, from angled crashes to glancing blows or fender benders. But we do have in Wisconsin, and like a lot of other areas, we have a variety of different roundabout designs. But the one thing that they all rely on is you yield traffic to your left. Smaller the roundabout, sometimes you really don't know if that person's exiting right before they get to you or they're coming all the way around. So you just have to slow down and yield to them. And unfortunately, I think roundabouts, because they allow you to keep going without stopping at a stop sign or stoplight, people feel like they should just take the roundabout as fast as they're comfortable. Well, you need to slow down and look to the left and always anticipate that car coming around the roundabout is going to come all the way around the roundabout until you see otherwise.
Courtney, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking back to my a long time ago, back in the 80s, I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, and I had never come in contact with a roundabout. And there, everybody had been doing it for a long, long time. Boy, was that a quick learning experience I had to take. They were usually not slowing down much when they got to those roundabouts. So the slowing down is really, and watching those cars on your left is, as you say, Randy, is really good advice. Richard in Beloit, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yes, comment on those roundabouts. Maybe they should put those rumble strips in front of them to slow them up, because they're always hitting it at 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But anyway, maybe some of these people every 10 years should have a education course, redriving test, so that they understand they're missing out on using their signals and using their proper techniques of driving. And the other thing would be with semis, we always have to have a safe distance in front of us, and that distance is always filled up on by cars trying to get ahead of the next car.
Yeah. Richard, thanks. Richard speaking from experience here, but Randy, comment.
Yeah, I can relate to Richard's experience because before I got into law enforcement, I drove semi-cross country for a couple of years, and it wasn't no different back in the early 80s than it is now. All you can do is control the vehicle that you are driving, but we've had a couple of people refer to that ongoing or continuing education for drivers, and again, I think that's a great idea. It's a great opportunity. I don't think that Wisconsin's going to be mandating that anytime soon, but it does not mean that individuals can't take it upon themselves and communities can't take it upon themselves to take that road.
You know, we should talk a bit more about driver's ed. Fewer teenagers are receiving driver's instruction through their schools. I mean, when I was in high school, we had to, you know, you get to that 16 or 15 years old, you could had to take the driver's test or the course. And I hope it's, no, I'm sure that it's changed a lot over the years. I remember having to watch a very gruesome traffic accident, a real one. And people were, the other, you know, some students were gasping and getting sick watching it. I don't know if those had any impact at all. Randy, that education program has changed considerably, I'm sure.
It certainly has. And actually in Wisconsin, there's very, very few high schools now that have their own driver's ed program. Most of it is privatized through private driver training schools or organizations like CESA that provide it outside of the school day. I'm going to refrain on commenting on that, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just times change. But driver's ed curriculum, ever since you started driving, Larry, and I started driving, relied very heavily on parent involvement. So you have behind the wheel, you take a course, you still do that. You can do some things online that we certainly couldn't back then. But it relies on parents behind the wheel. 50 hours of observation, I think, is the current standard here in Wisconsin. But I'll tell you, as long as you took me down this road, because I'm kind of passionate about teen driving, teens start to learn to drive long before we think they do. We now in Wisconsin allow them to get their temps, as we call them, at 15. It used to be 15 and a half. Now they're at 15. But they actually start to learn to drive. And there's some national research on this that we just picked up on and we're starting to work on here in Wisconsin. In fact, the kids start to learn to drive when their car seat turns around and starts facing forward. There's a very powerful video called Strings on YouTube that shows how kids learn what they see. And we should all know that from having toddlers and young elementary school kids, middle school kids, they're learning based on what they see their parents do. And if that is bad behavior, we can't expect driver's ed to fix that 6 weeks after they've been watching it for 10 years. So we have a lot of opportunity to improve our parent, what we call parent modeling, that'll have an impact on teen driving down the road.
That's really good. That's a very good point. I hadn't even thought about that, but you're just made me realize as you were talking about it. Yeah. I mean, the kids, they're paying attention to what their parents are doing. So if you're running a light like the guy who was in front of me this morning on the way to work, the yellow light was, you could see that it was going to turn to red. And he apparently assumed the red light was just a suggestion and went right straight through a red light. And you can imagine as dangerous as it was, but you could also imagine if he'd had a young child in the car with him. That's behavior modeling the wrong way.
Most, most parents have used the used the old adage of "do as I say, not as I do." But when it comes to traffic safety and learning to drive, I think it's a really important observation for our younger parents. You know, that they're modeling right from the time that the child turns 4 or 5, and so you can't let them see something for 10 years and then tell them, "Well, don't do it the way I did it," and expect good results, right?
Exactly. Karen and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Karen. So let's go to Tom and Madison. Tom, hello.
Hello there. This has sort of become a pet peeve call-in show, but I have more of a question related to one of my pet peeves, and it has to do with a stoplight intersection, and you're taking a left turn. How far into that intersection should you move to wait for oncoming traffic to take that left turn?
Well, I think the technical definition is you should not enter the intersection until you can make that left turn. But practically, I would not go, you know, where we see problems is you enter into the intersection and then you're halfway through the intersection, your wheels are turned left, the lights change, and there you are stuck. And that you can't be in the intersection once the light turns red. If you're in the intersection when the light turns red, you're violating that red light. So the technical answer there is you don't enter the intersection until you're able to turn left.
Very good. Very good education there. Let's go to Jonah in Ellington. Jonah, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. So it's my understanding that it takes 4 DUIs in the state of Wisconsin in order to be considered a felony. Why is it so high? And would you recommend, in your personal view, do you think it would be better for the safety of Wisconsinites on the road if we made it 3 or even 2 would be considered a felony?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good discussion point that it's outside my purview to really weigh in on you know, what our current laws are in Wisconsin, but I can tell you that you can do your own research and check the what it's like in other countries, for example, and even some of the other states, and what that does for repeat offenders. We have an issue with, and this is not just impaired driving, drunk driving, but overall, what I call the cultural acceptability of traffic crashes, whether they're from speeding drivers, red light runners, drunk drivers, distracted drivers. Traffic safety and traffic crashes is really a public health issue. It's a community issue. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's not a DOT issue. It affects each and every one of us. In Wisconsin, we kill somewhere between 575 and 600 drivers or people on our roadways every year. Every year. In the country, we killed over 41,000 of them last year on our roads. When you look at some of our counterparts in Sweden and Netherlands, there's no cultural acceptability for impaired driving there. You do it once, you go to prison. So that's something, it's a great discussion point, but it's something that people need to be involved in at the community level.
Thanks again for that comment. Karen in Madison is back, so let's go there. Karen, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, my topic is right on what you were just talking about. What is going on in Wisconsin and all over the United States is what is called tap accidents. They are accidents that are caused like a fender bender, what my father would have used when he was driving us around. And what the goal is to have the person's car hurt enough so that you can get a damage claim in and the insurance will pay for it. I had this happen in Madison down around the square. The driver stopped suddenly in front of me. He was in a van with a truck bumper on the back of it. I only tapped his bumper. There was no dent on either the bumper of mine or the bumper of his. But what did happen is the truck bumper was broken about 8 to 12 inches in, top to bottom, front to back. Not a crack. There was, I mean, you could see through it down to the ground. He said, I caused that. No way in heck could I have caused that damage with no damage to my front bumper.
Tap accidents.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of, unfortunately, I just have to say I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge. I'm sure it happens. I've not, I just don't have a lot of experience with that.
Yeah, can't comment on that, Karen. I appreciate your call. Lots of emails. Matt emailed to ask, what's the status of self-driving vehicles in Wisconsin, and can they operate in winter conditions?
That's another great big huge topic that we could run this show until about 5 p.m. today talking about self-driving and automated vehicles, right? Wisconsin has, we're the UW, what we call the UW TOPS lab in Madison, is part of a research program evaluating those. Bottom line is they're happening in other states. They're not in Wisconsin right now as far as self-driving, completely self-driving vehicles. Where we are with them, if you are able to buy one that has that capability yourself, as the you're still the driver of the vehicle, you're still responsible for anything that driver that vehicle does, meaning the technology may or may not work. You have to, you just can't get behind the wheel of a vehicle today and go to sleep and say, take me home. You're still responsible for whatever that vehicle does, even if it's in full automated mode. Interesting twist to that question was, can they drive in the wintertime? And I, again, it's outside my area of expertise. I'm sure that people will tell you, or the engineers will tell you, that they can or they will. But the bottom line is they still are relied, they rely a lot on infrastructure, meaning lines on the road and things like that, that the computer needs to be able to sense and see. So I'm sure winter driving here in Wisconsin is going to present some unique challenges for fully automated vehicles, but that's further down the road than we are right now.
Bill emailed, he's trying to convince his elderly father that driving too slow is just as dangerous as driving too fast. Bill's dad says, that's wrong. Who's right? Bill wants to know.
Well, both might be right. I guess it depends on the definition, which is a personal definition of too slow. Now, we have a unique issue with speed. And the bottom line is in Wisconsin, I'm sure other states are similar, but I spend a lot of time on speed. We're focused on it because if we lower the speed involved in any crash, we're going to increase the survivability. I'll repeat that. Lower the speed involved in any crash, whether it's a city street at 25 miles an hour or a highway at 55 miles an hour, you lower the speed involved in that crash, more people survive. Bottom line is, in Wisconsin, we know, we have the data to show that our speed limits are not our speed limits, they're the minimum speed. So a 55-mile-an-hour highway, most people consider that 55 or more. Nobody goes 52 or 51. So with that as the foundation, what is too slow? On the interstate, where the speed limit is 70, it's against the law to go below 45. Because of that speed differential, over 25 miles an hour in that example can be dangerous. But I would caution people to say that an older driver doing 50 or even 48, 47 miles an hour in a 55 zone, I wouldn't consider that too slow. I wouldn't consider that dangerous, because we all should be treating our speed limits as the maximum allowed speed on that road, not the minimum.
I was interviewed a traffic engineer who had worked in road construction and so forth. And he said that the way we've built roads is probably needs to be rethought, and streets as well. Because as an engineer, you always thought, well, we'll make the roads wider and bigger and faster. And the same with the streets, and it's basically probably just the opposite.
Boy, there's a lot of truth to that, Larry. And thankfully, Wisconsin's finally coming around a little bit. We were lagging a few other states in our country And as I mentioned earlier, referred to some of our international Scandinavian countries, for example. Yes, you're exactly right. We've been building streets wider and bigger and flatter for decades, and that drives speed up. And the higher the speed, the lower the survivability of any crash. So now you're starting to see a shift of narrowing streets, and we call it traffic calming and or road diets. Narrow the street a little bit, make people go slower, and more people will survive the crashes. And again, it takes a lot of time to shift a paradigm like that, but it's happening in communities just like Madison, Wisconsin, where they're designing some of the local side streets narrower and lowering the speed limit to 20 miles an hour from even 25 or 30, because it drastically increases crash survivability.
We just 2 days ago, they finished the street that I live on, and it is now much narrower and still involves the ability to park on one side of the street. And believe me, you're not going to go barreling through on our street because it's pretty narrow,
especially if there's cars, and that's intentional.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or even East Washington Avenue, where the rapid bus lane now takes up one of the three lanes, and now it's a two-lane road for traffic as opposed to three-lane.
Yeah, we went through a long period of time, and not just Wisconsin, but of designing our roads to minimize congestion, because whether we want to admit it or not, culturally, we're all in a hurry. We're in a hurry for whatever, it doesn't really matter what, but we're in a hurry, and we don't want to be slowed down by traffic. So we built bigger roads, more lanes, wider roads, and now we're kind of coming full circle where we realize that that seriously injures and kills more people. Whereas if we just would all slow down and reduce the amount of speed that's involved in these crashes, because we will always have crashes, people will make mistakes, we're never going to have perfect drivers, but the mistakes don't need to necessarily result in serious injury or death.
We have an email from Andrea. On her commute, there are several crosswalks with flashing lights to notify drivers of crossing pedestrians. She says sometimes people just activate the light and cross immediately, expecting to drivers to stop on a dime. What sort of responsibility or accountability do pedestrians have when crossing the street?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting issue in our urban areas. Those lights are super, super effective. They are pretty expensive to put in, but they're very effective because they alert drivers. But pedestrians have a responsibility they have a right to cross the road in a crosswalk and not be run over and killed. But they have a responsibility to make sure that the cars coming see the lights and see them. And we talked a while ago, Larry, about distracted driving. And there is a real issue with distracted walking. And so people, unfortunately, have their head down in their phone and they're walking and they see a crosswalk and they push the button and they just start walking across and they don't look up to make sure that the cars are going to yield. Even though the cars are required to yield, it's going to really hurt if the car doesn't yield and you step out in front of them. So it's a shared responsibility.
We are talking with Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff, detective, currently a law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Questions, again, you could email to talk@wpr.org or give a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today about driver education, driver safety, the rules of the road with our guest Randy Wiesinger, law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Dick in Brooklyn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hey, thank you, Larry, for taking my call. I lived in the Brooklyn area. I have a farm that I currently farm, though I'm in retirement. Local road commissioner, who's an attorney, stopped and told me that I needed to remove some weeds in the corner of a field at a four-way, a crossroads, one of which was controlled by a stop sign, because my weeds were impairing whether an oncoming driver who was at the stop sign, if he stopped there, he couldn't see if there was oncoming traffic from the other direction. Those weeds in my corn are well out of the legal roadway that I have there. I don't feel that's correct. He told me I had legal liability if an accident occurred. And I guess I want to know, is that true or is that incorrect? My feeling is the stop sign, if that's the case, the stop sign should be moved closer to the crossroads so that the driver can see it. But right now, even when I did remove the weeds, my corn still obstructed the vision of the driver behind the stop sign.
Yeah, that's it's kind of difficult for me to give you a definitive answer because it's unique to that situation there. But in general sense, I would say, every road has a right-of-way that the municipality is in charge of, and then outside of that road right-of-way is private property. I can't, describe your exact situation there, but in a general sense, I can tell you that we do work on sight lines so that people approaching that stop sign can see left and right. On one hand, I will tell you that having no sight lines until you get to the stop sign, you can't see left or right until you get to the stop sign, might cause people to actually stop versus roll through a stop sign. But at the same time, that's a specific instance where I'm not in a position to counteract whatever that commissioner told you, because I'm not familiar with the situation there.
Yeah, you'd have to almost see it to be able to make a comment on it, I would think.
As far as the liability, reality is we live in a lawsuit happy society, so you share some liability always, and anything you can do to reduce that is probably a good thing, but I'm not sure that you would be responsible.
Gene emailed, what's the rule of thumb for when you should be driving in the left lane on the freeway?
Well, we do have a statute on impeding traffic. I do take issue with sometimes the perception of that. Going back to my passionate plea about we need to slow people down and obey the speed limit. In Wisconsin, our speed limit is an absolute law, so it's not a guideline. It's not a minimum speed. It's a maximum speed. So 70 means 70 on the interstate. It doesn't mean 75 or 80, but we have a long ways to go there. So as long as you're doing the speed limit and you're in the left lane, technically you shouldn't be impeding traffic. But if you have traffic backed up, the ideal place to be is in the right lane when you're on a divided highway, or the furthest to the right lane and not in that left lane.
John wonders, how many points can you get or lose to get your driver's license, to get on your driver's license before it's revoked?
I don't think anything's changed. It's been a long time since I did anything with the merit points. 12 points in a rolling 12-month period will get you, more than that will suspend your license. Meaning a rolling 12-month period is after a year, and I think it's a little over a year, those points start to come back, and so you start earning your points back.
Mike in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Good morning. Just wanted to put a quick plug in for Ralph Nader, whose actions from the 1960s onward have probably saved tens of thousands of lives. That thought line. There's thousands of country roads that cross highways, and the stop signs could be wrapped with the newer LED lights and the solar panels. I'm curious to know if there's any activity or actions or moving forward to have some sort of progressive action to add that feature to rural stop signs. We had an incident north of Madison a year or two ago where three or four young kids coming home from a concert didn't see a stop sign, a country stop sign, because of heavy fog, and they got T-boned by a semi, and all of them perished, unfortunately.
Yeah, there is great technology to enhance the visibility of those stop signs. You know, in a general sense, I will tell you that unfortunately, we are pretty reactive, meaning we don't really, whether it's the local county or state DOT, tends not to address those until we have a trend of crashes. And that's unfortunate. I say that's unfortunate because sometimes we know where those issues are. We could proactively do something before we have that crash data, because crash data that drives decisions like that and funding decisions like that is important, but crash data is lives. Every number on our data sheet, if you will, is a life. So it's really up to those local communities, counties, and some do it more than others to proactively put those countermeasures in, but it comes at a cost. And so that's usually the driving factor, unfortunately.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. But lighting those stoplights would be it's probably an expensive proposition.
Yeah, I think that the cost is coming, is coming down. It's really one of those things where a community or a county or area needs to be proactive and decide that they want to do it before they have the crashes.
Brad in Minnesota emailed to say he thinks the minimum driving age for new drivers should be 18 or maybe even 21. Many European countries have a minimum age of 18 or 21. And their driver's education courses are somewhere close to a year. He is 54 now, got his license at 16, but looking back, thinks he had no business being behind the wheel at that age.
Well, I can't disagree with our Minnesota neighbor there, but how other countries approach driver education and teen driving does correlate with they kill less people on their roads. I don't think that Wisconsin's going to have an appetite for that. In my lifetime, we just lowered the age actually to 15 for you to get your temps from 15 and a half. So I think it really is incumbent on us as parents, and now I'm a grandparent, to properly train our drivers.
And Mark and Baraboo, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just have a general question. Last year, I was driving home from work on Interstate 94 in a construction zone. So you're going from 70 miles an hour down to, I believe it was 60. And there was nobody working that I could see. But one of the barrels, it got down to two lanes. One of the barrels blew over and was directly in my lane. And I was driving roughly, 60-ish miles an hour. And this is probably three car lengths ahead of me. What should happen in that situation?
I mean, obviously do what you have to do to avoid that barrel striking that. But if the lane is obstructed like that, that certainly warrants a 911 call. Construction zones, the speed limits in construction zones are reduced for a variety of different reasons, not always just because workers are present, but because of conditions that are present create hazards. And so we want people to go slower and mitigate those hazards, right? So just because workers aren't present doesn't mean the reduced speed isn't applicable.
And on that note, Randy, we are out of time. I hope you can come back and be with us again. I didn't get through everything I wanted to ask you about, and there was plenty of people calling in, and probably more that we could discuss. Randy, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Larry.
Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff Detective and liaison with the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Coming up, we got lots coming up here, including a visit with Brandy Grayson, founder and CEO of Urban Triage. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. I going to turn our attention now to homelessness. Larry Mueller here, but it is increasing in both urban and rural Wisconsin. I believe I mentioned earlier in Dane County this summer, nearly 800 people were reported without housing. That's an increase, I think, 7% from last year. And our guest now is grappling with this problem in the Madison area. Maybe some of the things Brandy Grayson is doing in Madison might apply to you no matter where you live. She's the founder and CEO of Urban Triage. It's a nonprofit organization, provides some education and housing programs for people in need locally. Want to hear from you. Maybe the cost scarcity of housing affecting your family, perhaps, or maybe your community at large. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brandy Grayson, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You started, founded Urban Triage in 2019, and you had a kind of a broad mission. What is your mission? What was your mission at that time, and maybe has it changed at all?
Urban Triage was actually created in 2014 as a response to state violence and the Black Lives Matter movement. In 2019, we became an official nonprofit organization. Of course, we started off doing grassroots work, but our mission at that time was to educate our community around the needs of those who are most vulnerable and provide tools and resources for community members, as well as institutions and systems to work together and for community members to navigate said systems and to systems so they can learn how to work with community members. That was our founding purpose: education, psychoeducation, systems education, navigation support, advocacy support. And while we were doing that work as a grassroots organization, housing became a challenge, because most of the community members that we would engage with would say, I would love to attend your work groups. I would love to do the work in educating myself and transforming my life, but it's hard to focus when I have nowhere to live or when I'm facing housing insecurity. So then Urban Triage started running crowdfunding campaigns through like GoFundMe to do eviction prevention, move-in, security deposits, and things like that. So prior to COVID hitting, we had already been doing some housing work, because we understand that to educate people and to help people uplift themselves and to transform themselves, they need their basic needs met so that they can focus on developing the skills to be successful, if that makes sense. So our mission has it's changed a little bit through strategic planning, made a little bit more simpler, I would say. But our mission now is to transform communities and institutions for a humane future for all. So it's still the same work, but just differently, I guess, framed so that people can digest it easier.
There's a program, or it's the Dane County 2.0 program, and you're involved, Urban Triage is involved in that as well, right?
Well, Dane County Core 2.0 was the program and initiative as a result of the COVID response. And Urban Triage was one of the leading contract providers for the COVID relief. And that ended in the end of 2023. So yes, Urban Triage had the second largest contract next to the airport with Dane County for that COVID relief program, allocating over $20 million to Dane County residents and housing stability funds and move-in funds to support people from moving from homelessness to house and to prevent people from losing their housing. So yes, we were involved with that when it was happening.
What? Talk a bit about the challenges. What are the challenges that Urban Triage has faced to become a provider of housing and rental assistance?
Oh, That is such a big question. there's so many challenges. Let's start with the challenges first that our community face. Our community is made up of different cultures, different folks who speak different languages, folks from different countries, environments, and oftentimes in Dane County in the Madison area, we've had the same nonprofits do some of the service providing, the direct services. And sometimes folks don't feel welcome due to language barriers or cultural barriers or cultural competence. So they have chosen not to use services even when resources are available because how people make them feel. And I know that that may be hard for some people to understand when you have never faced homelessness or you've never had to navigate systems, because some people will say, well, who cares how people make you feel if you're homeless or you need to eat or you need to feed your kids. But when you are already doing the best that you can and you already are lacking, let's just say when you already are facing the lowest point of your life, to walk into a place and to feel like you're dehumanized or treated like a thing, or you feel like people don't like you, or you feel like you should be embarrassed, or you feel judged, then you don't want to go back into that space. So you rather live on the street, or you rather not even access those resources. So I say that's a lot of what our homeless population is facing, this sense of being judged when they enter certain environments. And I mean, we know that is true because Madison in the Dane County area is one of the worst places to live in the country. And it's also one of the best places to live in the country. So we're facing this dichotomy of if you fit the right framework, right? If you fit like the UW-Madison framework, if you're in college, if you are a professional, if you ride bikes in a Toyota, drive a Toyota electric vehicle, then you kind of fit the framework of what Madison is looking for and what's acceptable. But when you are opposite of that, when you can't afford a bike, when you can't afford a car, when you're working two or three jobs and you have three children and your rent is 70% of your income, and when everything's going up, and there's a lot of judgment to that. There's judgment for the mother who has to leave their young kids with their older kid. And when you walk into social services or you walk into an institution, they say, well, how are you making it? Well, I work three jobs. One pays me $8 an hour. Another one pays me $15 an hour. Then there's an automatic judgment because one, people are seeing folks as not smart enough or not doing enough for themselves. And that's just not the case. Sometimes people just get dealt bad hands. So I say that complicates our work, right? So what also complicates our work as an organization, Urban Triage, is that we do very unapologetically center the needs of Black people. And when we say we center the needs of Black people, what people hear is that we only serve Black people, and that's not true, which would be really hard to do in Dane County when the majority of people seeking services are white people, right? But when people hear me say, yes, we're a predominantly Black-led organization serving predominantly Black people, then they say that we're anti-white or we're prejudiced or we're this or we're that. And we get kind of framed or put in this box, and it's not very helpful. And then it becomes this negative kind of connotation, but it only exists for us, because it doesn't exist for Central Hispanic, Hispania, which is a nonprofit organization serving predominantly Latino and brown folks. No one asks them like, why aren't you serving white people? You know, but because we say that we serve Black people, folks are often offended by it. So we face racism, systemic racism. We face judgment, and being led by a woman, of course, also compounds it in a very loud woman like me who's just says whatever I want, whenever I want, is also not helpful. So all of those things compounded, but I also gotta say that we do amazing work, and it's hard to not notice the work that we do. So I wanna like just thank Dane County for being one of our partners in the work that we do in housing, and that we've been able to work hand in hand with Dane County and launch and implement some amazing programs that have been very impactful. So yes, it comes with complications and compounded effects because of who's leading and what we're doing, but also we do work in very strong collaboration with the City of Madison, United Way, Roots and Wings, and Dane County. So I guess I would just say yes, and that the work is challenging and it's amazing. It's amazing.
gotta be amazing and probably frustrating at times.
Yeah.
How do you, I mean, I'd like to know a bit about some of the programs that you have been working on and successes that you have had. Maybe they could be applicable to other parts of Wisconsin as well as Madison and Dane County.
Yeah, so we have, we run the housing navigation services through Dane County in partnership with Beacon, which is a day shelter. We're also at Salvation Army supporting their work in the evenings a couple of times a month. And we're at the library and we're at different locations in our community and doing outreach in our community for folks who are sleeping on the street or sleeping in their cars or living in places that no humans should live. We serve that population of people through our housing navigation support services. So if they find us where we're at the Beacon or other locations, our housing navigation specialists will help them develop what they call an individual plan and assessment, looking at their barriers, and then we'll help them create or support them creating a plan to overcome those barriers. It could be ALDA issues. It could be mental health, emotional behavior issues or challenges. We have relationships with different mental health partners where we can provide people with direct referrals so they can get in a little bit sooner than other mental health services. We work directly with landlords throughout Dane County, private landlords, property managers that we have agreements with, that we say, hey, if you let us have so many of our clients move in to a unit, then we'll do this thing for you. And that thing usually means that we'll come on site, do outreach, education. So we have these tremendous relationships that allows us to place people who are, some will say, unhousable, you know, chronically homeless people or folks that just have been dealt terrible hands in life, whether it's veterans, right? We work with a lot of veterans. 30 to 40% of the people that we serve is over the age of 60. So some of our folks have disabilities. They can't work. Some folks don't qualify for Social Security. I mean, there's so many challenges and barriers facing homeless folks and folks who are housing insecure. So we have our housing navigation support. We have our Dane County Rapid Rehousing. It's a program, and again, with collaboration with Dane County, where we, again, support people who are chronically homeless, but we place them in housing and we help them with 3 months of rent, security deposit, and provide wraparound services. And wraparound services is ongoing case management, connecting them to resources, visiting them every week or every other week or once a month, whatever they prefer, but checking in with them, making sure they have what they need, helping them with job search, job training, education. We do that. Then we have a couple of HUD programs that we run. Youth domestic violence program. Again, it's a rapid rehousing type of program where we provide rental support for youth, wraparound services for youth. We have a couple of transition, what we call scattered transitional units. And that's where the units are actually leased to Urban Triage. And then we place youth who are homeless and running from fleeing domestic violence into these units temporarily as we work with them and develop them for permanent housing. And then we have our emerging adults program, which is also in partnership with Dane County. This is a transitional house that we run in partnership with Dane County, and youth aging out of foster care have access to this house where they don't pay rent, but they can live up to 2 years. We provide wraparound services. It's a real life house. It has like 9 bedrooms. We have 24/7 support services staff on site to help them navigate systems, job education, job placement, to support them in connecting with mental health supports, volunteer work, everything that you can think of that a youth may need to prepare to be successful on their own. So we also run that in collaboration with Dane County. We do outreach work, which through the city of Madison. We also run educational work groups with the support of the city of Madison and public health of Dane County also funds some of that work. United Way funds some of that work. So we do education, we do agriculture. We run about 10 or 12 programs. Our agriculture program is rooted in teaching people how to grow their own food, how to farm, how to enter agriculture ventures. And we distribute about 5,000 to 10,000 pounds of organic produce every year from about June through November. Every week until Thanksgiving, you can come to 2312 South Park Street and get free produce. And it's all certified organic from our farm. We teach people how to farm. And we also teach people how to grow hemp and how to enter the hemp market and the CBD market. So Urban Trash does a lot. And we build garden beds throughout Dane County. So we do a lot of food and housing support services.
You are making me really tired. I get tired just thinking about all of the work that you are doing and your
group,
Brandy. How many folks do you have working through this whole process in Urban Trash?
We have 25 employees.
And how are you funded?
City of Madison, a little funding, Dane County. Federal funds, most of our money came from federal government, HUD, USDA for our agriculture program. We've lost most of our funding because of the new administration. We lost money from USDA. We don't know how our agriculture program is going to survive next year, but we're working on a strategic plan. A lot of our statewide initiatives was funded through federal funding to improve our homeless systems. We also lost funding from EPA because we were part of the EPA change grant with the city of Madison. So we lost funding from that. But most of our funding is grant funded, federal, county, city, state.
Somebody has to write those grants. Is that you?
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. But we did hire a grant manager last month. So this is the first time in Urban Trash history that we have an on-site grant person. I've written all the grants. I do all the management, CEO, CFO. I make sure everything is running smoothly.
Oh my goodness me. It's just hard to imagine all that you're getting done here. How many people do you think? You probably don't even know how many people you've actually helped, because if you help an individual, that person may be responsible for two or three or four other people.
Yeah. So we have drop-in hours. People just come and show up, right? Word of mouth. They hear about what we're doing and they have friends and families, that we've supported. So every week we have about approximately 100 to 150 people stop in our office on Park Street for assistance. Every week we have about 200 to 250 people we provide produce to every week. And then we case manage about 200 people regularly. So in a given period of time in the month, we can touch between 500 to 1,000 people. And that's including individuals and families. And that's through our outreach, our programming. It's a lot. And our staff is people that we've served. So we hire people that we've served, people that we've actually moved from homelessness to house. We often give them jobs because they are the folks that can serve the folks who are now in the same predicament in a more humane way. It's one thing to be educated in social work or case management from like an academia perspective, but it's a whole new meaning when you've lived it. And then you're serving people. It fulfills a whole deep, a meaningful purpose for our staff, and they show up differently. So we actually can work at the capacity we do because the work to them means the world to them, right? It's meaningful. It gives them a reason to wake up, and it also has moved them from poverty to sustainability, which also fuels their energy and their desire to get people housed, if that makes sense.
Other communities are facing these similar issues.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that not every community, in fact, probably very few communities have somebody like you with the capacity and drive that you exhibit. What is your advice to other people or other communities about meeting the kinds of problems and dealing with the kinds of issues? It's not, I don't know, problem is always seems like a bad word for that.
I know.
But how do they even begin?
That's a big question. The work of Urban Triage began from the heart. Urban Triage was built at my kitchen table. It was built from a desire to support and empower. And the thing about any work that you do, it has to be your purpose. I don't think that anybody can just come step in my shoes, right? It's like this is God-driven. And I don't know, some people don't believe in God, but this is really God-driven purpose. And also, I would encourage people to do small acts every day. Small acts to take care of your neighbors, small acts to take care of yourself. I have a deep routine to make sure that I'm emotionally, physically, and spiritually grounded and well, because it takes a lot out of you to do this work. So I get up at 5 a.m, right? And I'm already reading, writing, reflecting, working out, meditating, talking to God. What am I supposed to do today? What am I supposed to do better than yesterday? And do I go left? Do I go right? Do I respond? Do I not respond? And I don't do it perfectly. It's messy. You know, human work is messy work. But my advice to anyone that's interested in starting or launching an initiative is make sure you're launching it from a place of serving people and not helping people. We don't want to disempower people. We want to empower them. We want to give people the tools to get to where they desire to be. And you do that by asking people, what is it that you need? Right? And supporting them in obtaining the things that they need. Because if we sit and we listen to the people that are most vulnerable, they actually do have the answers. But oftentimes, most of our programs are ran from a system down kind of perspective, top down. And that's our culture. That's the American way. Let me tell you what you should do. But the work really needs to start from the bottom up. So I think the most important thing we can do is respect the words of those who are most vulnerable, hire the people that are most vulnerable, and gain the tools and the skills to educate yourself and others. And it's not easy work. Now, I don't say that like it's easy to take someone from poverty and homelessness, house them and give them a job and educate them. It is a balance. It's a very challenging balance at times.
Well, it's too bad we don't have some kind of copy machine that we could copy likenesses of you, Brandy, and spread those likenesses all over the state and country.
Yeah. Well, you can still help me by donating, right? So part of the work, you know, is that nonprofits are losing money. If you're paying attention, there's been this back and forth with the county and the sheriff, right? Like, do we fund homeless nonprofit programs or do we fund police, right? And I'm not here to take a stance on either way right now. I think what's most important is that we center the most vulnerable. And some of us have privileges and resources that other people don't have. And some of us are hoarding some of those privileges and resources because we too are afraid, or you're afraid that it might not be enough, but you're afraid and the way that you're living doesn't compare to the folks who have to sleep in their cars or on the concrete. And some of these folks aren't who you think they are. Sometimes we think, oh, they're drug addicts. They're losers. They don't want to get well. Some of these folks fought in our wars. Some of these folks are elders who are differently abled and are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because they fought in our wars. Some of these folks are suffering because they got sick and had a heart attack and lost their jobs or had a stroke and didn't have the medical insurance to rehabilitate or didn't have the family. For example, I don't have a family. I'm a ward of the state. So if I get sick or something happens to me, who's going to take care of my kids? They might end up in the system. Some of us don't have the same resources and the privilege and foundations. And I think we just have to recognize that from a human perspective and support the folks who are doing the work. And if you're unable to physically get out there and do the work, then support people financially. You can do that by going to urbantriage.org, right? Donate $5, $10. Become a reoccurring donor. Specify in your donation where you want the money to go. You want it to go to food, you want to go to stipends, you want to go to clothes, you want to go to youth, foster kids, women fleeing domestic violence. Wherever you want your money to go, we'll make sure it goes. But we need the money, y'all. Like, this is a time where we need to move from this place of red and blue, Democrats and Republic, to a place of humanity. What do we do, right? What do we do about the folks in Jamaica? How do we come together? It's things that are happening outside of our control. But the one thing we can control as human beings is how we respond to it. And the more that we stop arguing about who is right or wrong and take action and focusing on what is needed, that's when I think we can see more light inside of each of us. So I would encourage people to do that.
Urbantriage.org is your spot. Brandy, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you. And thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate you.
Thanks for being with us today. Brandy Grayson, founder and CEO of Urban Triage Incorporated, and the website urbantriage.org if you'd like to help out in any way. I know she would appreciate it very much. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the Sow Sisters, as in S-E-W, the Sow Sisters. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to a group of 18 seamstresses known as the Sow Sisters, who provide crucial protection for the crews of NASA's fleet of space shuttles. And our next guest is a member of the Sow Sisters, Gene Wright, former NASA aerospace composite technician for the United Space Alliance. She was one of 18 Sow Sisters. It's an elite team of seamstresses who sewed the thermal protection systems for the space shuttle. Their work protected astronauts from radiation, extreme heat when the shuttles re-entered Earth's atmosphere, for example. And she's Jean's the subject of a new children's book. It's titled Sow Sister, The Untold Story of Jean Wright and NASA's Seamstresses. And you can join the conversation. I hope you'll give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Gene Wright, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I tell you, it was beautiful being up there at the EAA Museum. I missed the weather up there.
You know, and that's how we kind of learned about you. And it's such a fascinating story. Not many people can say they were a seamstress for the NASA, for goodness sake.
That's true. That's true. It's a little frustrating when they find out that I was a seamstress for NASA. And I understand the majority of people say, oh, you sewed the spacesuits. And I go, no, that was Massachusetts and Delaware. I've been to both the sewing areas. But no, we actually built flight hardware for the space shuttle.
I watched a video of one of your presentations. It was absolutely fascinating. I wondered, how did you get interested in sewing and then the space program?
Well, I've been sewing since I was seven. Just had my 70th birthday on Monday. And Mrs. Hansford, who was my next door neighbor, was a childless woman. And I have a twin sister, Joan, and we used to go over there and she would show us how to sew. She was very nice to us. And it's important to sew plaids. And she taught us how to sew plaids because you want a really nice looking article, and how to use a steam iron. And she just turned 90 this past August, because I wasn't sure she was even still alive until I had contacted her when the book came out. And so that was in Flint, Michigan. And so I'm a Michigan girl. I'm a Michigan girl.
Yeah, well, you're a Midwesterner, so you know you fit right in here in Wisconsin for sure. And the space program, how'd you get interested in it?
Well, I guess like most people around my age, and back in 1969 when we walked on the moon, I just was captivated. And I remember going out with my sister, looking at the moon, hard to believe that we actually had men walking on there. And somehow, even though Michigan was so far away from Florida, I just knew somehow I was going to end up there. That was something I always wanted to do. Just wanted to.
And you were pretty persistent. And I think your persistence may have gotten you into the Sow Sisters team.
Yes. Even before my interview, I would read anything I could on thermal protection. I watched NASA TV constantly. My sister and I kept scrapbooks from Apollo 7 on that are now falling apart, but we still have them. But it was just something we were always interested in. And
how did you get picked?
Well, that's the first thing everybody asks is if you saw an ad in the paper, and they were doing return to flight for SCS 114 after we lost Columbia. So there was an article in the paper, and I thought, wow, you know, I knew they were sewing, didn't know to what extent. So I wrote a resume out. And I didn't hear anything for 6 months because NASA keeps the resumes for 6 months. Tweaked it, and then 4 days later, I had Kennedy Space Center on the caller ID, and I thought someone was playing a mean joke on me because they knew how desperately I wanted to be out there. Long story short, it was January 24th of 2005 that I had the interview, and it was 2 hours long in front of 4 different people, and they were asking me all sorts of questions, and they seemed pretty impressed with my knowledge, which made me happy. And after I was the first one out of 4 ladies to be interviewed, and after my interview, my eventual boss invited me out to go out to the thermal protection facility, and I just assumed that was a courtesy given to people because we hadn't hired anybody in our building in 8 years. So that was a Thursday. On Monday, I got a call that said, Kennedy Space Center on the caller ID again. I was with my older daughter at the time, and I said, this will be the most important phone call your mother will ever get in her life. And it was them telling me that they wanted me. And the reason why I asked my boss, he said to me, you had no idea when we invited you out there that I had hired you the second you left the room. And I said, no. And he said, well, you know, the Space Center had a lot of hurt with losing 2 shuttles. And he just said, there was a spirit about you, just a light, he said. And I told the other people on the panel, she knows a lot, but there's just something about her, and I want her. I'll interview the other ones, but she has the light and the spirit I think this building needs. So it was me. I was so lucky.
And you were the last to join the Soul Sisters, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And the reason why there was even an opening, the woman who I ended up getting her work bag, her name was Ruby, she had asked to be transferred out because, as you can imagine, we work with fiberglass and quartz fabrics and everything else, and she was getting kind of itchy and just was looking for something new. And the reason why they had an opening is because, of course, the shuttle program was down for a couple of years after we lost Columbia, and we had a lot of contracts that we had to finish with finishing up the International Space Station. A lot of countries had counted on us to put their experiments on and everything else. So my boss, when he hired me, says, you're going to hit the ground running because we really need to get caught up on all of this.
Well, so the material that you stitched, the white material on the outside of the shuttles was fabric that you stitched.
Yes. Those are called fibrous or flexible insulated blankets, initially called AFRISI. But we've been flying blankets. It's a quartz fabric, a quartz thread, spun quartz batting, fiberglass backing, and depending on the heat load the blanket was going to get, we made them in 11 classes from 1 to 11, roughly a thickness of a placemat to 2 inches thick. And believe it or not, they could do the same thermal protection as the tiles did, which was anywhere from up to 650 to 2300 if they were black. The blankets were primarily in the white tile range of up to 1300 degrees, but it saved us a ton of weight by switching to the blankets.
Yeah, so, and you know, when I first, before I knew anything, before I looked into this I envisioned fabric, and so I'm thinking about like the blanket I had on my bed, which is
smile,
and I'm thinking, how the heck do you take fabric and make it into something that can withstand that kind of heat?
Well, you know, that's probably my number one question. People ask me, how in the world can you make fabric from stone? And I ask the same thing of my engineers. And the closest we could replicate would be, if you've ever seen cotton candy being made and they take sugar and they melt it to a liquid, we take finely ground quartz and melt it to a liquid. And then from there, it's almost like making candy. You lift that thread up and when the air hits it, it makes like a thread. So then they twist it around and weave it into a fabric. But it's actually quartz stone that we make the fabric out of.
Oh, man. Jean Wright, our guest, former NASA aerospace composite technician was her official title with the United Space Alliance. one of the Sew Sisters, an elite team of seamstresses. Questions for her. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Jean Wright, our guest today, one of the 18 Sew Sisters of seamstresses who sewed the thermal protection systems for the space shuttle. Again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. So let's talk some more about the, this is amazing to me that you were not only using sewing machines, but you were hand stitching.
Oh, yes. People were shocked when I tell them. I would say at least 40% of the flight hard we built was literally with a needle and thread. And what's fascinating to me is something that's been around since Egyptian times and beyond. We need all that technical skill for everything building shuttle. And the shuttle had 2.5 million parts, not soft goods. Soft goods meaning anything to do with fabric is what we did. But a number, and you know the reason why? There's a lot of reasons why. If we had film that was too thin to put through a sewing machine, we would pre-punch our holes with an awl. Or if we were working with a special thread, because we had a special high-temperature thread called AB440 that was a coarse thread, but it melted at 3,200 degrees. And it's funny, the higher temperature it goes, you would think it's a tough thread, but really it frayed a lot. So we would, it couldn't go through a sewing machine. So we had to sew that one by hand. And that would be primarily in the nose area, thermal barriers in the nose landing your door. But people think it's the bottom of the shuttle that got the hottest, but it wasn't. It actually was right underneath the curved chin panel of the nose in the, where the wings indented in the shuttle were the second hottest area. That we made special blankets for all of those areas too, internal. Internal.
Yeah, and the internal temperatures varied an awful lot, too.
I would say that's a good one. Well, space is plus 250 or minus 250, so the internal blankets would probably be, we rated them for 2,000 for the payload bay blankets, but they wouldn't see that. But we also had silver polyimide blankets, over 5,500, that we made out of a special silver film, and that was the barrier for radiation for the astronauts. So those would be underneath the white payload bay doors, all that work you would never see. But, 5,500 silver blankets underneath that we built as well.
I'm wondering about tolerances. I mean, your work had to be really exacting.
They did, and I appreciate you asking that, because when I tell some people, I know there's a tendency to some people go, oh, it's just women who sew. We had 1/100,000th of some of our tolerances. We even had special rules or scales that showed really detailed marks. Our stitches were 10 to 12 stitches per inch, plus or minus an inch, and quality would be there with their scale ruler, making sure we were in that spec. But, no, we really had tight tolerances because everything had to fit perfectly.
It just amazed me looking at some of the photos of the work that you actually did. You had a special project. I thought that was really kind of cool, involving a historic fabric from the Wright brothers.
Oh, that's sweet of you to ask. You know, I would have to say my time working on the shuttle was probably the highlight, but that would come a very, very close second, because I had met the Armstrong brothers, oh gosh, probably back in 2016, and at a space function. And long story short, 2018, Mark Armstrong called me and said he had a special project he wanted me to work on in celebration of the 50th anniversary the next year, and also the movie First Man coming out. And he said, you'll get a call. So I got a call from Sarasota at the CAG auction house, and basically it's what they wanted me to prepare the fabric their father took to the moon from the 1903 Wright Flyer, and I had to cut the pieces for them to get them prepared for auction. So that was wonderful.
It's amazing to hold that in your hands.
Well, when I first walked in the room, I thought how appropriate. It was shaped roughly like the state of Ohio, which, of course, they're from Dayton. I had tears in my eyes because I still couldn't believe that I was actually in that room. And I had a schematic to cut to. The fabric had a lot of it was stored after the Wright brothers flew. They put it in a shed in Dayton. And gosh, they had a flood in 1913. And the fabric obviously had it had coal dust and rust and mildew. It was a special muslin called Pride of the West muslin, which at the time was a very finely woven cotton, which would be perfect for wings. And this fabric happened to come from the upper left wing of the Wright 1900 flyer. The story I tell is the women in the town used to watch them working on the plane, and then would say, "Wow, that fabric is so expensive," because they used it for ladies' undergarments, and they thought, "What a waste of beautiful fabric on a project that would never work." But it was called Pride of the West, and it was bought from Wright Cumbler Department Store in Dayton, Ohio, for the fabric.
And you tell the story in your talks of the first seamstress involved in flight, and it had to do with the Wright brothers, and I think it had to do with the width of the length of the wings or something.
Oh, yeah. Actually, there were two, the Wright brothers used two sewing machines, one in Dayton, and then when they got to Kitty Hawk, they found that the pine spars that they needed for the width of the wings wasn't long enough, so they had to meet. There's a woman there that put them up, Ida Tate, and she put them up and let them borrow her sewing machine. I think it was a Singer that she bought. It was an 1899 Singer that she purchased for less. I think it was $1.99. But Wilbur was the one who always did all the sewing, and he had to shorten the wings and make new casings for them using her sewing machine. So I've been fortunate that I've actually seen both sewing machines and actually been able to touch both of them, which is a seamstress is a thrill for me.
So what are the sewing machines like that you use? I mean, you're not going to buy them off the like the thread. You're not going to buy the thread over at the local clothing center or whatever. The same with the sewing machines, I assume.
Well, we had, you name whatever sewing machine we did, but yes, we did have some really neat ones, industrial ones, of course, that were big. We kept up a tradition of naming our sewing machines, and that tradition began with the seamstresses that worked on the Apollo spacesuits. They worked with two big singers called Big Mo and Sweet Sue, and we've kept up tradition in our building by naming the machines, and even the lady who built the spacesuits even now, they named their machines. So, yes, we had a 1914 Singer. That was a small one that we added a section to him. His name is Lurch, and he's now about 6.5 feet long. And he's the one that actually does the two rows of what we call closeout stitching around each of the outside shuttle blankets. But he also is the machine that we would use to quilt the blankets that go around the engines. And speaking of the engine blankets, when people ask me the most unique hand sewing we did on the shuttle, I would have to say it would be those blankets. They're 8.5 feet across. They're for sound suppression around the engines. They're called dome heat shield blankets. And Lurch would be the one that would quilt the 125 rows that radiate out from the center out. And we had two of those on each engine. But we would actually have to hand sew up sleeving on the edges. But what makes that so fascinating is we actually had an Inconel wire thread that we would hand sew the blankets onto the back of the around the shuttle engines. So I think that's probably the neatest hand sewing we did.
It's just amazing to me to think of the outer shell is really fabric.
Well, you know, it was they built the tiles downstairs in our building. So technically we're called the Thermal Protection Systems Facility. It's right across the street from bays 1 and 2 where the shuttles would go in to be processed. The tiles are made downstairs. We ladies sewed up on the second floor. But we could quilt a 30 by 30 inch piece of fabric on this, believe it or not, a 30 needle sewing machine. There's only two in the United States, one in California and one at Kennedy, and it quilts a 30 by 30 inch piece of fabric. And from there, we'll take our patterns and decide what size or shape it's going to be. But that was a unique one. But you know what's the tricky is we could fit, depending on the size of the tile, up to 25 tile in that same 30 by 30 inch piece of fabric. And even though the fabric was heavier, we could cover a bigger surface area. And the beautiful thing about the fabric is once we glued it on, and if it got a tear, we would just hop up there, put a little patch on it, hand sew it on like you're fixing your jeans, and then coat it with the ceramic paint that we coated the blankets with. So if you look closely at the shuttles, you'll see patches all over them.
Julie in Lincoln, Nebraska has something. Julie, hi.
Well, hello. I just wanted to call in because when your guest was talking about her background, mine was the same. I grew up in Wisconsin. I watched the space launch and walking on the moon, and I wanted to be a doctor to the astronaut. I went to UW, but unfortunately, I didn't quite make it. Eventually, I became a food scientist, and our group in Nebraska had some connection to NASA for astronaut food. So not a direct link, but just a sister, same age.
That's sweet. You know what? We have the astronaut headquarters here, and after the shuttle program ended, I wanted so bad to be one of the cooks that worked for the astronauts.
Well, you're actually a docent.
I am. We're lucky. If you had any time on any of the programs, be it Apollo, shuttle, we're docenting up at the Atlantis exhibit because we are fortunate enough that we have Space Shuttle Atlantis, and we always go up there. We pick someone who has like knee thermal protection or somebody who's worked on engines so that we can answer their questions. Or if we have a big launch, we do escorts. And when we had our first Artemis 1 launch, we packed 10,000 swag bags to pass out to guests over a course of 4 days. So we do a lot of escorting and everything else. You know, it's a wonderful job. You keep your foot in, your little toe in there, and I'm still NASA badged, and we still get to see astronauts all the time.
Oh, man. And here you are, the focus of a new children's book by Elise Matich, titled So mm-hmm. Sister, The Untold Story of Jean Wright and NASA's Seamstresses.
And you know how that came to be? I met her at the Atlantis exhibit back in 2019, and she said she wanted to start a series of women, kind of like hidden figures that people may not have known what their story was. And so over the course of a few years, even through COVID, we wrote each other back and forth. I sent pictures. She's a beautiful writer and illustrator. And the book came out on October 3rd, a couple of years ago, and I smiled when I found out what the release date was going to be, because that was the first day that Atlantis launched into space. Was October 3rd.
And you,
so I thought it was a good omen.
And you have garnered a lot of attention as a result of that. How does that feel?
Well, as I keep telling everybody, it's not so much about me. It's just that I want people to know, especially everybody thinks with NASA, you've got to know math and science. And yes, we had to figure out how many grams of bedding to go into part because we had math calculations we had to do too. But I just want people to know NASA's looking for creative people who know how to write, draw, people like me that sew. I just want especially kids to know that, yes, if you're all right in math and science, which I was okay with, but I'm more of a creative person, I just want people to know that NASA's looking for everybody, and I want to be a good ambassador to let kids know that, yeah, there's a chance. If you have a dream, and you know, if you have a unique specialty, that NASA probably in all likelihood will need you.
That is so cool. So young women who want to pursue a careers in the space program, give it a shot. No matter what your particular ability is, you don't have to be an astronaut, or you could be.
And you know, we've come a long way. We had, when we had our Artemis 1 launch, Charlie Blackwell Thompson is our first female launch director. And I have a few of my lady friends that are working on Artemis, the next rocket that's due probably in February to be launched to go to the moon. But like I said, back when I was little, we really didn't have any chances. And now women especially have the field is open out there.
Oh,
Jean. That makes me happy.
Jean Wright, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a pleasure talking with you and learning about the So Sisters that I didn't know anything about. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thanks to Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and And of course, a big thanks to you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store.